This is Robert J. Shaw, S-H-A-W, and my current address as of May 25th, 1990, is 1617 South Beverly Glen Boulevard. Glen is spelled G-L-E-N. Beverly Glen Boulevard, Los Angeles, California, 90024. My telephone number is area code 213-470-5840. I entered the University of Wisconsin as a freshman in February of 1936, and I graduated with a BA in the class of 1939, and then stayed on an extra year for the first year of law school in 1940. I should also add that of the 6 or 7 years that I was at Madison, I stayed nearly every summer and took courses in the summertime. I had my father and parents, I think, convinced that I was ambitious and overly studious, but the fact is that with Lake Mendota and the Sigma Nu house on Henry Street and a pier and a lot of beer to drink at Lohmeyer's and the Rotskeller, the summers at the University of Wisconsin were simply great. And I took extremely difficult courses like Music Appreciation Number 1 or Storytelling for Children 102. Consequently, I had great summers, and my family still thinks that perhaps I was overly ambitious. It asks where I graduated from high school. I went to high school at Shorewood High School. That's a suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I would say immodestly, I graduated in the class of 1935, and I was also the valedictorian. Why did I decide to attend college? Actually, in those days, whether or not you attended college wasn't much of a choice. You simply went. Nearly everybody I knew went to college. So it never occurred to me not to go. I did not consider any other colleges other than the University of Wisconsin for a very specific reason. My father, James D. Shaw, was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin Law School and became a very prominent and successful Milwaukee attorney. He was chief counsel for the Milwaukee Electric Railway and Light Company and the Transport Company, the Wisconsin-Michigan Power Company, and had a considerably good reputation as a lawyer. And consequently, no one ever asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. My father had no other children. I have no brothers and sisters. He had no brothers or sisters. Consequently, there was a great, big, thriving law office waiting for me. And I was the only one for whom it was being kept alive. So consequently, from the time I was 5 years old, people patted me on the head and said, "What a great law office you're going to have." So I never gave a thought to being anything but a lawyer. As I will confess very freely later on, it turned out that I was a very indifferent law student and didn't like law and certainly never became a lawyer. But that's why I selected the University of Wisconsin, because I was going to learn Wisconsin law on the assumption that I would end up in my father's office in Milwaukee. Did I have a career goal in mind? Yes, it was put on in my mind for me. I was going to be a lawyer. As a matter of fact, looking back, I never thought about it very much. I just took it for granted. Now it says here, as a freshman, did you remember any hazing that took place? If you're talking about the entire freshman class at the University of Wisconsin, even in those days, it was a big class. And I remember really no hazing of any kind. I certainly don't remember things you see in Eastern colleges, wearing funny hats or freshmen being hazed or required to do one thing or another. I remember none of that. In fact, I could almost be pretty positive in saying there was very little freshman hazing in my day. As the records indicate, I was an English major, and I've been asked in this questionnaire attached to doing this tape to refer to some of the English teachers of English that I had. And oddly enough, my fraternity brother, Paul Godfrey, was at that time the editor of the 1938 Badger. And he asked me to select outstanding faculty people and to write about them in the Badger, and also to select outstanding undergraduates and to write about them. And I have a copy of the 1938 Badger in front of me, and I notice on page 187, I wrote about my favorite teacher. Well, naturally, I was no idiot. It didn't do my grade, I think, any harm for me to include her as one of the outstanding members of the faculty of the University of Wisconsin. Her name was Ruth Wallerstein, and I can read or quote directly what I wrote way back then about her. And I said, "Spirited, precise, and individual, Ruth Wallerstein stands as a living symbol of honest intellectual effort. To her students in English literature, both undergraduate and advanced, she is the friendly representative of higher, hard-earned learning." Well, oddly enough, all these years later, my recollection of her is such that I would write exactly the same thing again. Helen White was the head of the English department. I knew Helen White and was cordial, and we had a pleasant relationship, but actually I thought of Helen White much more as an administrator than I did as a teacher, and strangely enough, I never actually had a class that she taught. Oddly enough, on this same page of the Badger I just mentioned, the 1938 Badger, on page 187, one of the other faculty members that I chose to eulogize in the Badger was a man who was a good friend of mine, and I think a remarkable influence not only on me, but practically on any student he came in touch with, and that was a man named William H. Kiekhofer, who conducted Wisconsin's largest lecture course, Economics 1A. We used to call him Wild Bill, and I don't think I ever would have dreamed of cutting a class of his. And actually his, well, as I wrote in the Badger, I can quote again, "Editor, text writer, lecturer, economist, and businessman, William H. Kiekhofer conducts the Wisconsin's largest lecture course, Economics 1A. Forceful and yet convivial, his platform, manner, and presentation send beginners out eager to go further in his field." That was certainly true of me. I seriously considered doing something about economics simply because of Wild Bill Kiekhofer. I do not recall, while being an English major, that there were any clubs or organizations and activities available to an undergraduate who was an English major. Consequently, in answer to a question here, what clubs and organizations activities were available, I don't remember any. We simply studied English. I did have one very memorable to me and exciting experience in the English department. When it came time in my senior year to do what in those days was called a senior year thesis, I wrote about James Weldon Johnson, a black poet. And the method in those days, and it may still be true, is beginning of the first of the semester of your senior year, you go to a member of the faculty who becomes your thesis advisor, and you give him a grade card and almost a year later, in June, when you finish your thesis, he puts down a grade and gives it to you. And I chose a remarkable man named Wallace Stegner. Most people know that Mr. Stegner is the chairman emeritus of the Stanford University English Department now, and is also a distinguished prize-winning novelist in his own right. But in those days, he was just a good friend, and did, I think, something wonderful in the sense that I handed him my thesis card in which he was going to put a grade 6 or 8 months later, and he looked at it and put A on it and handed it back to me and said, turn it in June and now go do the thesis. I have read everything he's written, and I think of him as a tremendous influence and a man I envied, and a man I emulated, and a man that I only wish I still do, but he still know, but he's up in Stanford and I'm down in Los Angeles, and that's the way of the world. One of the questions mentioned here in this guide to doing this tape is, name your favorite class outside the English department. Who taught it and what made it so memorable? Well, that's a very easy one because, and again, in that same Badger, I wrote about another teacher. As I said before, I was not an idiot. And this was a man almost internationally known, certainly nationally, as a liberal teacher, and his name was Walter Agard. And I took almost every course I could that he taught and sat spellbound by him. Again in the Badger, when it came time for me to select him as one of the outstanding faculty members of my era, I wrote about him, a courageous official in Local 223 of the American Federation of Teachers. Walter Agard has spoken sharply and without hesitation, sending forth a clear conception of the liberal point of view, broad in scope. From his office in the Classics Department, news has always come. I was extremely taken with Professor Agard and still think of him as a tremendous influence in my life. To give you an example, the kind of thinking and kind of teacher he was, I remember at the end of our first year of a class I took that he taught, we filed in for our final examinations with our usual stack of blue books, and he passed out these mimeographed exams very solemnly. And the exam to this day, I can remember, consisted of one sentence. And at the top of the page, Dr. Agard had written, "The University of Wisconsin rules require that I give you a final examination. Therefore, I would appreciate it if you would spend this time telling me in your blue books how I might make this class better next year." And that still seems to me my idea of a good teacher. Now, somewhat related to this same area of teachers and people who were of great influence upon me, there are three or four more I'd like to mention, even though this might be a little out of sequence with the outline presented. I would certainly start with the dean of the law school, a man named Lloyd Garrison, and many people knew then and probably still do. Lloyd Garrison was a descendant of a distinguished American family going back to signers of the Independence, and he was a brilliant dean and a certainly nationally known and renowned dean of law. As I said much earlier, I only went to law school because my father was a lawyer, and I was certainly not a stellar student in the first year. I was much too busy with the Daily Cardinal and a few other things. So consequently, at the end of my first year of law, Dane Garrison called me into his office, and that in itself kind of shook me, because usually you get called to the dean's office, dean of law school at least, only for one reason, and that's to get thrown out. But he was extremely affable, and he began immediately by saying, "Don't you like law?" And of course I saluted and said, "Oh yes, sir, I enjoy it very much," and so forth. And he smiled and said, "Well, you don't come around very much to prove it." And then it became obvious that he was talking about our friendship, because I had interviewed him many times for the Daily Cardinal, and I didn't know him. I just didn't know him as a law student. And he looked me right in the eye, and he said, "Are you afraid to tell your father that you don't like law?" And I said, "Well, sir, you have to understand about my father. He's a lawyer in Milwaukee." And he interrupted me, and he said, "You don't have to tell me about Jimmy Shaw." He said, "I've known him for 30 years. I testified for him in maybe 100 trials. I have tremendous respect for him. We are still teaching law that he promulgated here." And he said, "I know him." And he said, "Would you like me to write to him and tell him that you are not exactly ecstatic about being a lawyer?" And with great gratitude, I said yes. And I left, and about 3 weeks later, he called me into the office, and he handed me two envelopes. The first one was from my father, and it was addressed to Dean Garrison, and it began, "Dear Lloyd," which impressed me. I didn't realize they were on a first-name basis. And my father had written, "Please, at your convenience, tell Robert that when the torch finally falls from my failing hand, I do not necessarily expect that he will catch it. Signed, Jim." So I looked at the letter, and then Dean Garrison handed me a second letter. This one was written on his own letterhead, the University of Wisconsin Law School, and it was addressed to the editor of the New York Times, and it had one sentence. And the sentence was, "Here is a bright boy I think you ought to meet. Signed, Lloyd." And with the feeling of absolute ecstasy, I put that letter in my pocket, and the next day at noon I was on a plane to New York, and by Monday I had a job at the New York Times. So that, I think, will give you some idea of my affection for Dean Lloyd Garrison. I should also like to mention the man who was then governor, Philip La Follette. Well, of course, he doesn't qualify actually as a member of the faculty. Nevertheless, he was very close to the university. And as some people remember, he was highly instrumental in getting the president of the university fired. The president of the university was a man of distinguished letters, a magnificent speaker, a man of erudite, highly sophisticated qualities, named Glenn Frank. And I had known Glenn Frank, again, as a reporter for the Daily Cardinal quite well, and admired him tremendously. And it became obvious that there was a political storm brewing, in which Phil La Follette, for reasons of his own, wanted to get Glenn Frank out as president of the university. And they held an open Board of Regents meeting. It ran around 3 days, and I attended all 3 days, and I listened in absolute horror to the castigation of this, I thought, brilliant man, Glenn Frank. And the members of the Board of Regents in those days, while they may have been fine gentlemen, nevertheless were, by and large, small-town, upstate Wisconsin farmers and plain folk. And I remember, to my astonishment, one of the accusations brought against Glenn Frank was that when he entertained visiting notables on the campus, his wife sent to Chicago for caterers and food rather than use, and I remember one region saying, good old Wisconsin products. So that was really the essence of why Glenn Frank was fired. And I was so highly irate about it that with four or five others, I organized a march. And we marched downstate from Bascom Hill down State Street to the state capitol to Phil LaFollette's office to protest his engineering of the dismissal of Glenn Frank. And there were about 3,000 of us who had cut class and marched. And my picture was in the Milwaukee Journal leading the march, which I assure you, my father being a very conservative attorney, wasn't too happy about that. But that was my experience with Governor LaFollette and with Glenn Frank. Finally, one last teacher that was in and out of both the university and my life briefly, and that was Sinclair Lewis, a distinguished writer, author. And they had arranged for Sinclair Lewis to come to the campus for a year, take up residence, and teach writing to a select group who had to qualify by submitting samples of their work. And I did qualify. There were perhaps 20 of us that he selected for his class, and he held his class in a rented house on the university campus. And naturally, he was a fascinating man. But on the other hand, he was not very taken with the lives of academia. Some mornings we'd get there and he'd be there. Some mornings we'd get there for class and he wasn't there. There was also a considerable amount of vicious gossip about a young lady who may or may not have been in residence at the house. But there was great talk about that and even newspaper articles and so forth. So as a result, Sinclair Lewis's class didn't last even one semester. And I always regretted that because it would have been a distinguished experience, I think, to have been taught by Red Sinclair Lewis. Now passing on to other sections of this outline or interview format that someone has provided me, one of the areas I've been asked to talk about is membership in Sigma Nu, my undergraduate fraternity. I should say now that I don't have the opinion of fraternities that I had then. I'm not at all sure that fraternities are a good thing, for the simple reason that at least in my day, they promoted a uniformity. All Deeks wore crew cuts. All Sigma Nus did this. All Phi Gams did that. I regret that to become a member of a fraternity in those days, you gave up some of your individuality. And I think I resented that even from the beginning. I was a practical guy, and there's a question here. It says, when and why did you decide to join Sigma Nu? I joined Sigma Nu because most of the important positions on the Daily Cardinal were occupied by members of the Sigma Nu fraternity. And that's simply the reason I joined. It had nothing to do with my being enamored of the social aspects of the fraternity or the people in it. They were nice people. There were nice people in all fraternities. But my chief objective was to get to know these people who were running the Daily Cardinal. Says, describe Rush I didn't bother to rush. In other words, I didn't go from one fraternity house to another by invitation and shake hands and get the usual glass of punch, because I made up my mind I was going to join a fraternity for the obvious reason that I could meet the people I wanted to, in that case Sigma Nu and people on the Daily Cardinal. So I didn't bother with any other fraternities. One of the things that I am not sure is a good thing about fraternities is that each of them in those days was kind of notable for one particular thing. All Phi Gams had were members of the basketball team. All so-and-sos were members of the football team. Others were campus politicians. Each fraternity had its own reputation for its members, and Sigma Nu was largely campus publications. One of the things I did do is once I got into Sigma Nu, I'm not the kind of person that would ignore or simply take for granted being a member, so I worked very hard to change a lot of things, and I'm happy to say I succeeded. We got rid of Hell Week entirely. There was no such thing as all this adolescent nonsense of paddling and making pledges, literally slaves to the actives. We got rid of that largely because I stood up on my two hind legs and hollered and yelled until we did get rid of it. Turned out that I became president of the fraternity in my second year, and I remained president of the fraternity for the whole 4 years that I lived there at the fraternity house, which incidentally was located at 625 North Henry Street. In place of hazing or adolescent antics that some fraternities still clung to, we instituted at Sigma Nu a system called the Quest, which on Saturday night, what would normally be called Hell Week, on the Saturday night before your initiation on Sunday, each pledge was given an object to find and bring back to the fraternity house. And this required a certain amount of intellectualism and imagination. And we would take the pledges and set them free in the middle of the night with no car, no money, and they had until morning to achieve their quest. Sometimes these quests were obscure books hidden away in private libraries, and they would have to think it through to the point where they would realize that's where I can get it, and go get it, and bring it back. And it became an interesting game. There was nothing rough or nothing hazing about it. It was a challenge, and I liked it. I also, at the same time, wrote a manual for the national office of Sigma Nu on how to attract new pledges and in many other areas how to run a fraternity. I did that as a labor of love one summer while at the campus, and so far as I understand, it's still being used. It says here, describe initiation. Well, I'm sure anybody who's been initiated into a fraternity has pretty much the same story to tell. You dress in very strange black robes, and there's lots of candlelight, sometimes incense, and a great deal of nonsense written about the glory and the tradition of the fraternity. Sigma Nu was founded at Virginia Military Institute in 1869, and a great deal of the institution of the initiation had to do with talking about the devotion to the brothers in those days. And the initiation was, of course, followed by a dinner. And I can remember my own initiation. No, the one after mine. We decided to invite guests to the dinner, and our first guest was the Dean of Men, Scott H. Goodnight, whom I'll get to in a moment because he was also a good friend of mine. What kind of social, cultural, and intellectual functions did Sigma Nu participate in? Well, I think we can almost skip the intellectual functions. I can't remember any. Social, sure. We had the Sigma Nu annual Christmas dance and the Sigma Nu annual party, usually at country clubs in and around Madison. I remember a country club, I think it was called Maple Bluff, where you reserved the ballroom months ahead of time for your annual fraternity party. To me, looking back, the most exciting social part of Sigma Nu, I shouldn't say that, there are two parts, but one of them was certainly the fact that we had a pier on Lake Mendota. We owned a sailboat, an ice boat, and in the summertime it was a great place to lie and get the sun. At noon, on a Friday at Sigma Nu House, if you could get three other brothers with a dollar each, a quarter barrel of Fauerbach beer was then $4 delivered. And we would get a quarter barrel of beer and go down and lie on the sun on the pier in Lake Mendota and skip class. And that was, I thought, just great. We not only drank beer together, but I should also add that certainly in the 4 years that I lived at the Sigma Nu House, I made some good friends. And I met people who even then had the prospect of becoming fine people, and I'm sure they did. I haven't seen a great many of them, but we were a happy and contented group. How long did I live there? 4 years. Approximately how many people lived there? I would say about 40. The rest lived in the dormitories or around the campus, and on Monday nights we all had dinner together in the fraternity house. On other nights, just those of us who lived there. A woman named Mrs. Ellestad, E-L-L-E-S-T-A-D, ran a rooming house on Langdon Street, and I also hired her to run our kitchen. So she was the cook and bottle washer and a delightful woman who kept a great many hungry Sigma Nus adequately fed. I had a roommate. I had several, but the one I remember most is a guy who's still living in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where he lived then. His name was Jim Kleiner, K-L-E-I-N-E-R. And I was very, very fond of Jim. We became very good friends, and I think of him often, even though I haven't seen him in perhaps 50 years. The dining room was in the basement, and it was one great big long table, and I presided as president at the head of it with a button which called the waiters in the kitchen, because as fast as I could eat, the kids in the, around the table could eat faster and raise their hands, meaning they wanted seconds. I remember a boy named Carl Klatka, who so helped me, could drink 8 glasses of milk before I could even begin to get into my own dinner. Food was served by student waiters. Some of them were members of our fraternity, and some of them were outside students. Manners and etiquette were stressed to an extent. We did require that you at least looked halfway decent at mealtime. Not so much in the morning, of course, because that was, you just came down and got your own breakfast, or by that I mean you ate breakfast alone or whoever was there. And lunch was a fast-moving thing. A lot of people had classes to go to. But dinner at night, we tried to urge people to at least put on a shirt, and we succeeded. We didn't allow roughhousing or screaming or yelling, that kind of thing, at dinner at night. And nearly every night, if there was time, we sang. We sang Sigmund Hu songs and other songs. And looking back now, it was part of the fellowship and part of the good feeling. Strangely enough, one of the things I remember most about living in the fraternity house, people of that era will probably remember him too, around 11 o'clock at night, there was a man who made his way from one fraternity house to another, one sorority house to another, with a great big basket of sandwiches and milk, other soft drinks, and he was known as TK. T is in Tom and K is in kind, and the nickname came from the fact that he would open the door and holler TK, meaning 10 kinds of sandwiches, and we'd all flop out of our rooms. Some were asleep, some were studying, mostly were in pajamas, and we'd all sit on those stairs and eat TK's sandwiches and milk, and that was a nightly ritual in not only my fraternity house, but I think in most of them, and it was fun. This outline asks, what were the house rules at Sigmund Hu? They were simply the rules of good behavior. They weren't printed out that I can recall. Certainly nobody brought a girl into his room at Sigmund Hu and made loose with her. We respected each other's privacy, and we respected laws of decency, I guess is the way to put it. It was not a den of iniquity by any means. So it says here, how are violators penalized? There weren't any violators. There were very few. There were no violations. Were there any fraternities or sororities with which Sigmund Hu had especially close ties? Well, of course, the ones in and around Henry Street. And did any rivalries exist between Greeks and Independents? Yes. That, I think, has been going on since fraternities were invented. The Independents, I think, thought of us as an elite, and we thought of them as kind of Philistines, especially in campus politics. When it came time to elect a student president or a vice president of the class or president of the junior class, whether or not you were a Greek meant a great deal in the election. Outside of that, I can't remember any vicious rivalry. We didn't hate each other. I spent a great deal of time in a place called Lohmeyer's drinking beer, and I was never very conscious of whether I was drinking beer with a fraternity man or a sorority girl or an independent. I notice in these notes, one of the questions asked about fraternity life before we leave that subject is, was there a prayer offered? I suppose that means at mealtime. And the answer is no. Looking back, I cannot connect life in Sigmund Hu with any religion. I don't even know now if some of my fraternity brothers were religious, if they were Catholic or what. Consequently, religion just did not enter into it. As I'm sure everyone knows, there were in those days Jewish fraternities which admitted only Jews. And as a result, in Sigmund Hu, for example, we had no Jews. Whether that system still prevails or not, I don't know. If it does, I don't think it's a good thing, because I think a mixture is better. There are two more things about fraternities and sororities that I'd like to comment on for just for a moment. There was in Madison in those days six sororities, and they were called the Big Six. And they were, in most people's opinions, the top six sororities. And when we gave a dinner dance or a Christmas party at Sigma Nu, we were especially happy if some of our members were bringing dates from the Big Six. I dated a girl named Betty Hill for 3 years. She was a Delta Gamma. That was part of the Big Six. I sometimes wonder why I didn't marry her, because her father was president of the Nestle Chocolate Company. Finally, going back to what I said earlier about not being at all sure that fraternities are everything they should be, I remember with, even today, I remember with great sadness, a thing called depledging, which is simply that you pledge a boy, and then when it comes time to initiate him, the active members vote. And one blackball can keep a boy from being initiated, and you don't even need to explain it. It can be done in secrecy. Then it became my job as president, for instance, to go out to the Trip Hall or Adams Hall, wherever this pledge lived, and ask if I could take him for a walk and talk to him. And then I had the ungodly job of explaining what amounted to, we don't want you. And I hated that. And I hate it now. I think it's one of the things that's terribly wrong with the fraternity system, if it still exists that way. In your early years, 18, 19, to suddenly be told that a group of your compatriots don't want you, must be a shattering thing. I've only seen the other side of it. I've had to tell 10, 15 kids that we were de-pledging them. We didn't want them. And I tried so hard to think of ways to explain why we didn't want them. None of them were adequate. And to this day, I cringe when I think that that is also, or at least was then, part of the fraternity system. Now turning to a new subject in this outline, which is leisure time. Now, one of the first questions suggested might be discussed is, how much leisure time did you have and how are you likely to spend it? Looking back, I had a lot of leisure time because I was not a grind. I was not a student determined to achieve high grades, and as a matter of fact, looking back at my college record, I did not achieve high grades. I managed, for the most part, what I think is still called in some colleges a gentleman's C. I got A's in English and F's or D's in mathematics. I think I took freshman algebra twice, and then once again in the summer, and then finally with some tutoring got through it. I was not much at science either. I think I managed to avoid taking any science course until my senior year, in which Dean Goodnight, Scott Goodnight, called me in and explained that you can't graduate unless you take at least one freshman science. So I found myself, to my horror, going back and taking freshman botany, which I assure you, I did not distinguish myself. Now, getting back to leisure time, nearly every night of the week, after studying a limited amount of time, maybe 2-3 hours at the most, we would collect at the fraternity house, those of us who wanted to, and go to usually Lohmeyer's. That was called Fred Lohmeyer's. It was on the lower campus on State Street, near the lower campus, and it was a beer joint. And Fred also allowed you to open charge accounts, and provided you paid your bills once a month, you could sit there and drink beer even if you didn't have any money. And the place was always crowded, and there were always people you knew. And when I wrote a column for the Daily Cardinal called The Troubleshooter, which was essentially a gossip column, it was at Fred Lohmeyer's that I got most of my material. It was for people stopping at our booth and telling me things that were going to happen. On a more elaborate date or evening, we might go to a place called the Amber Inn, which was also on State Street, down further toward the Capitol. And then for something really special, we would go to a nightclub out on the highway called the Cuba Club. Many of us, of course, were underage as far as drinking was concerned, and I can't remember a single instance of ever being refused a drink or even questioned as to how old I was or to show an ID. Those things just didn't exist. If you were in college, you could drink. That seemed to be the attitude, and it certainly was the prevailing method of dispensing alcoholic beverages in most of the campus joints that I remember. How much time did you spend in the Memorial Union? I think before replying to that, it's time to turn the tape over. So if you'll turn the tape on the other side, we'll continue. Thank you. Now I'm continuing from the other side of this tape. And we were at a point in which the suggested question in this outline is, how much time did you spend in the Memorial Union and what might you do there? And as I recall, I said on the other side of this tape, I did not spend much time there. In the first place, I have heard and seen the Memorial Union as it is today outside, and it's an extraordinarily beautiful, exciting place, and right on Lake Mendota. And I think if I were in school today, I'd spend a lot of time there. But in my day, the outside was not nearly as elaborate as it is today. And if you drank beer, you drank most of it in a rotskeller inside. And it was always crowded and noisy. And it wasn't just the kind of place where you'd go where two or three people to sit around and talk. So I didn't spend much time at the Union. I don't know why. It just never was a place that appealed to me, with one exception, and that was there was a rather expensive, rather elegant dining room in the Union where you even made reservations, as I recall, and where you could take people to dinner, preferably on a, for instance, a Sunday night. And there was a kind of a nice, quiet, genteel, educational environment about it. And it was a very beautiful room. The food was good. And I remember using that dining room a great deal, and for dates and for all kinds of occasions. And that's about my total recollection of the Memorial Union. In slight connection with the Union, I happened to be an undergraduate when the University Theater, or whatever we called it, I think it was called the University Theater, was open. And I recall... the opening night was, of course, a very gala occasion with the governor and the boards of regents and so forth. And I had a vague connection with it. I forget how. I think a committee of some sort. The stars of the opening night performance were the Lunts from Genesee Depot in Wisconsin. And I can remember... one minor incident. Just before 8 o'clock, the curtain, somebody had waxed most of the floors backstage, and Lynn Fontanne, I am told, I was not there, fell on her way to the stage, but picked herself up in theatrical tradition, and the show went on. The reason I mention all this is years later, when I was in the entertainment business in New York, I became very close to the Lunts and remained so until they both died. Spent a great deal of time with them at Genesee Depot in Wisconsin. And one night when we were sitting around, we recalled that they did indeed open the University of Wisconsin Theater. And Lynn Fontanne also vividly recalled the highly waxed floors. The outline that's presented to me asks about major social events of the year. I think I've already mentioned a few of them. Certainly the soft shuffle, as we used to call it, the junior prom and the senior dance were major events of social calendar of the year. So was the winter carnival ball, the military ball, and then each and every fraternity and sorority had its own Christmas party. And those were all very major events. We were very chic in those days. Black tie was very second rate. You rented or owned white tie and tails and a top hat. And we thought we were very elegant. And the junior prom, I suppose, was the biggest and most important event of all. And I remember as a columnist for the Daily Cardinal, one of the things that we wrote about to show you the extent of our readers' interest was who was going to be the entertainment, what band was going to play for the junior prom. And that became a matter of wide concern. And I can remember there was a committee, of course, appointed to choose, and some of the orchestras that I remember now playing for the junior prom with Wayne King, the Waltz King, as he was called, and a fraternity brother of mine, Kay Kaiser, and Tommy Dorsey. And Tommy Dorsey in those days had a young skinny singer named Frank Sinatra. Those were big nights on the campus, the nights of the junior prom. This outline also asks about the attitude, prevailing student attitudes, male and female, concerning alcohol, tobacco, and drugs. Of the first two, alcohol and tobacco, I can't remember any prevailing attitude at all. In other words, it was a total lack of attitude. People either smoked or they didn't, or they drank or they didn't. Most of us drank. Beer, of course, was the drink of choice, except that at fraternity parties, much against the university laws, but nevertheless, all fraternities did it, we would have punch. And punch was usually made with we had one called in those days the Earnshaw Special, which was made with canned grapefruit juice and alcohol. That's why nearly every fraternity made an effort to pledge or to have at least one member in the medical school, because he could get medicinal alcohol, which is much stronger, I think double the proof of regular alcohol or vodka or gin. And this so-called delicious punch was made simply by canned grapefruit juice and medicinal alcohol and a big chunk of ice. That, as I remember, was the standard alcoholic drink in big fraternity house parties and functions of that kind. Out on a date, we very seldom ordered alcoholic drinks such as cocktails, would be called today. Beer was the standard campus drink at places, again, as I mentioned, like the Amber Inn and Lohmeyer's and so forth. As far as drugs is concerned, to the best of my ability, I can't remember the matter of drugs even being mentioned in the whole time I was at the university. This was pre-drug period, and I know perfectly well I never experienced drugs, and I don't know of any friend of mine on the campus who did. Undoubtedly, maybe some did, but certainly it was not as popular or as extant as it is today or was recently. The word marijuana, I don't think I ever heard in the whole 4, 6, 7 years I was at the university. And certainly we never got involved in harder drugs. Cocaine was just something that was unknown to us. And I can say unequivocally, I remember no drug problem of any kind. Now continuing, the major spectator sports on campus in my day were exactly what I assume they are today. The football was perhaps more prominent than any other. In the years since, basketball has become much more important than it was in my day. In my period, the football season in the fall was an exciting, wonderful time. Saturday afternoons going to the game, Saturday nights at the fraternity house, we invariably had either an impromptu party or one that we planned, and a great many alumni dropped in during the day that people would come back for the game. Homecoming was a big event on the campus. We all decorated our fraternity houses, dormitories. To go to Camp Randall and watch the football team, whether they won or lost, didn't really make much difference. Was a big, big part of the fall and a very exciting part. And looking back now, a great deal of pleasure and fun. Intramural sports, I do not recall as being very popular. Certainly, in the Sigma Nu house, we had no teams that played other fraternities in anything. Our sports were pretty much centered around Lake Mendota, and they weren't really organized sports at all. It consisted of ice boating in the winter and speed boating in the summer and swimming and just playing, lying in the sun, drinking beer, if that can be called a sport. Sigma Nu did not have any athletic teams whatsoever, so therefore I had no involvement whatsoever in them, nor was I ever, and even to this day, much of an athlete. Now turning to another subject, it asks here, how was your education financed? I was lucky. My father was successful and also very generous. So I simply went to college and told his secretary how much it would cost, and she sent me a check every month. My father was not only a good lawyer, but a very sarcastic one. And occasionally, I would do things that all undergraduates do. I wrote him a very long letter, I remember, in which I worked very hard and explained that I had forgotten that I was a junior and a member of the junior class officers and expected to attend the prom, and therefore I needed some extra money to rent tails and top hat and buy a ticket to the prom and a corsage. And I ran the expense account up to maybe $100 or so and asked him to send it to me. And I remember I got a letter back quite promptly with no check in it. And the letter said, "My dear Robert, let us not for a time at least kill the goose that lays the golden egg." And that was the end of that. But he was very generous. I had everything I wanted in college, and I paid for nothing. I certainly didn't have a student job. I didn't need one. I wasn't eligible for a scholarship. And like I think a great many others, I was in college because my parents could afford it, and they managed to keep me in college in good style without my doing anything about it. Now this next question kind of interests me because I hadn't thought about it. It says, discuss the role religion played in your campus experience. Discuss your involvement with any, if any, with campus religious houses. How did your campus religious practices compare to your pre-campus religious practices? Well, I simply have to say I am not religious, and I was not then religious. I was not brought up in a religious home. We practiced no organized or definable religion. So that when I got to the campus, I didn't expect to take part in religious activities, and the fact is I did not. In all the years I was at the university, I cannot remember attending any religious activity or any function, social or otherwise, at any church or mixing with any particular church group. The same thing was true of the members of my fraternity, the Sigma Nu House. Religion was just not part of our program. We weren't against it. It simply didn't exist. I can't remember any religious experience connected with the fraternity, or for that matter, connected with my whole career at the University of Wisconsin. Religion was just not part of it. I hope I'm not implying that I was against it. I certainly wasn't. I just really, looking back, wasn't even aware of it. I knew that there were religious organizations and groups, and churches had student groups, but they had nothing to do with me, and I had nothing to do with them. It says, you note that you were Howard Weiss's campaign manager. How did that come about? Well, as I was always interested in campus politics, and Howie Weiss was one of Wisconsin's more celebrated football players. We hadn't had a star in a long time, and he was certainly it, and he was also a friend of mine. He was not a fraternity brother. He belonged to another fraternity. But it occurred to me that I might have a little trouble getting elected class president, but I could certainly get him elected because he was the Saturday afternoon campus hero. So I remember approaching him first, and he was agreeable. And then I went to see the football coach, who later became a good friend of mine, Harry Stuhldreher, and told Harry what I had in mind of making Howie campus senior class president, and would it interfere with his football problems, and it didn't. So it was kind of fun. I would take Howie over to, well, for instance, once each night we would drop in at a sorority house, and I would present the football hero of the week, and he would make a brief talk to the girls, and they voted for him, and he became the president of the class. And I was very touched just recently, and this is parenthetical, but this being 1990, my mother at age 92 died only a few months ago in Milwaukee. And of course at 92 you can hardly call it a tragic occasion, but we had a funeral for her in Milwaukee. And when I looked up, suddenly a face I knew that I recognized, but I couldn't remember from just when or what, and it was Howie Weiss, whom I hadn't seen since we were undergraduates together. And he came to pay his respects to my mother, and I guess to me, and I was very touched and very pleased. Howie became an important insurance man in the city of Milwaukee. It was fun being his campaign manager, and of course there were rewards in it. I got anything I wanted in the way of free tickets to the junior prom and the senior dance and that kind of thing. And also we had a certain éclat on the campus. We were popular. I was also a class officer by election in the class of 39. And that was simply a matter of, I ran my own campaign. I didn't have a campaign manager. And I can look back now and think one reason I probably got elected is there wasn't very much competition, as I recall. It was a breeze. I got elected, and all I remember really as a reward was free tickets to the, I think it was the junior prom, and making Betty Hill my prom queen. There were practically no responsibilities, incidentally, connected with being an undergraduate class officer. It was largely an honorary title. Now we turn to the Daily Cardinal, which was a big part of my life on the campus. As I've said earlier, I joined Sigma Nu because so many people in the fraternity were already working on the Cardinal, and in no time at all, so was I. And I did not only interviews and that kind of thing, which gave me the rare and privileged opportunity of meeting a great many of the faculty and getting to know a great many of the students, but I also wrote a column called The Troubleshooter. I wrote it with a good friend of mine, Wade Mosby, whom I saw recently. Wade became the Milwaukee Journal television editor after college. And in as much as I was in television, we kept up a kind of relationship even to this day. But Wade and I wrote this column called The Troubleshooter, which was out-and-out gossip column. Who was going to be prom queen? Who was dating whom? Who was breaking up with whom? There was that kind of trivia, which I can defend in the sense that people also read people like Walter Winchell in those days, and he wrote same kind of stuff. He wrote it better than we did, but that was our main interest, was in the social side of college life. The Troubleshooter was very seldom serious. We very seldom got into discussions of any particular weight or even merit. It was an out-and-out troubleshooter column of gossip, and obviously extremely popular. To my amazement, not only did most students read it, but so did most of the members of the faculty. Also, looking back at the Cardinal as a whole, as a campus newspaper, my impression today, I think, is that it was a very good campus newspaper. I have since seen many others, and the Cardinal was, even then, important. It was an important part of university life, and it was also instrumental. I can remember the Cardinal used to go to press around midnight, as I recall, and it was ready for distribution around 4 o'clock in the morning, and it used to be piled up in front of the old red gym next to the Memorial Union. And one particular issue contained some political matter that a friend of mine named Ed Fleming objected to. Ed later became a very prominent television and radio announcer of national importance. Ed was a student politician and a very bright one, and he pulled off one of the exciting things of the year. He and with the help of unknown friends collected the entire daily edition of the Daily Cardinal, hundreds, thousands of copies of it, and dumped them all in Lake Mendota because he objected to some political story that was in the paper. And that caused a scandal and an investigation. Nothing ever came of it, of course,
but it was a lot of fun and typical campus antics while it lasted. Now we come in this suggested outline, to me, a very interesting part of this taped oral history, or whatever it's called, and that is whoever has prepared this tape, prepared this questionnaire, has indicated section 9, student attitudes, and it says, describe student attitudes toward women, Jews, blacks, other minorities, out-of-state students, and foreign students. I very clearly remember that there were attitudes toward these people. I don't remember any particular bias about women. Women were just half the student body, as far as I could see. There was no prejudice about women. And, of course, in my particular world, the world of fraternity house, politics, low Myers drinking beer, women were also highly desirable for many reasons, including dates. I don't remember much anti-Semitism on the campus. There were very fine, outstanding Jewish fraternities, and they were as much a part of the fraternity world as any other fraternal house was. I don't remember any attitude toward them whatsoever, except that, for instance, there was a Jewish fraternity and there was Sigma Nu, and the twain met often. I don't, again, remember any attitude of any particular description about blacks on the campus. To be quite honest, looking back, I am not aware that there was a preponderance of black students. They were very much in the minority. On the other hand, I cannot recall any instance of prejudice about them. They were simply there. They were not what I would call an important part of the campus scene. They were very distinctly a minority. I don't remember much about other racial minorities. I do, however, remember being very much aware of out-of-state students. The University of Wisconsin in those days, and I hope today too, had a reputation as being a very liberal institution. And even the state of Wisconsin, going back very far into history, was a liberal state. Excuse me. So the university attracted a certain element of foreign students and a certain element of students from out of state, notably from the East Coast, especially New York City. Many of these people became good friends of mine. They were an interesting breed. They were a breed apart. They weren't like those of us who simply went to college because our parents had money and simply went to college because beer drinking was fun and got through it the best we could. These kids, I remember several telling me they hitchhiked out in their freshman year to enter the university and simply didn't have enough money ever to go back for Christmas vacation, and even in the summer they would stay in Madison and try to earn enough money to get through another year. They also worked very, very hard at being students, and they got great results. They were the brightest in any class I can remember. The guy who was first on his feet with the answers, both in law school and in undergraduate classes, was quite often the guy from New York who'd been up half the night studying. I talked to a great many of these people because I liked them and I admired them. And I remember once asking a boy named Richard Goldstone why he worked so very hard and didn't take time off to have much fun in college. And he said very simply, he couldn't afford to. He couldn't go back to his parents and not be the top of his class, not be the very best. That's why he was there. That was an attitude that was new to me. I learned from it, I respected it, and of course I still do. Were you aware of any communist or radical student groups on the campus? No, not in particular, certainly not communist. It was too early for that. I don't think 9 out of 10 of students with whom I went to school would be able to define in those days what a communist was. It was simply Russia was very, very far away. Toward the end of my college career, when the 40s began to approach, I took a summer off and I worked for my national fraternity, for Sigma Nu, traveling through the East, inspecting other chapters, and found that Eastern University students were much more aware of the impending World War II than I had been at the University of Wisconsin. The following fall, when I got back, I tried many times, especially in my own fraternity house, to explain that a great many people felt that war was coming. But I must honestly say, with some regret, we didn't believe it, and we didn't give it much thought. I'm sure there are people on campus who did, students as and of course faculty. But in our fraternity life, things went on very much as before. The prom queen was much more important than whether or not there was a man named Hitler about to overrun what he hoped would be the world. So if I have any regret, is that we spent too much time being unaware of the world around us. We were very insulated. I don't remember at the Sigma Nu house, I don't remember reading a newspaper. I certainly, except the Cardinal, of course, I certainly don't remember watching the television news or radio news or whatever it was in those days. We were a world unto ourselves, and the rest of the world just went on without us. I regret that. But nevertheless, I have to admit, looking back, it was true. We were not aware of what was happening in the world. We were only aware of what was happening on the campus of the University of Wisconsin. That's a slightly exaggerated statement, but I think there's truth in it. We had no radical groups that I remember. I'm sure they were there, but they were so minor, they never came to my attention, and I certainly never joined one or knew anything about them. There were very few controversies or student protest type movements in my day. Later on, many years later, when I would read about students at Columbia mounting the stairs and halting the campus activities, when I would read about the wonderful activities at Berkeley and the students who prevailed, and I envied them, and I looked back with some horror at how could I have been so dumb in the whole 7 years of the University of Wisconsin. Why wasn't I aware that there was a world around me? So if there were radical students, and there were a few, I envied them. I certainly didn't object to them. Quite the opposite. Looking back now, I wish I'd known them better. I wish I'd been brighter. Now the accompanying suggested list of topics here discusses or gets into personalities, and it says, among other things, discuss Scott Goodnight, Dean of Men. Well, I've already mentioned him several times. We were good friends. Going back to that same Badger that I've mentioned so often, the 1938 Badger, when I was asked to choose and write about both members of the faculty and selected students, I wrote about Dean Scott Goodnight. And again, on page 16 of that same Badger, I can read now what I wrote then, which was, every September the octopus used to run a picture of a completely sinister and devilishly appearing old man who seemed quite ready to bite babies and kick widows out in the snow. And underneath was the caption, "Gentlemen, meet the dean." In a school the size of Wisconsin, there must be many, too many if you ask him, who never got beyond that stage in knowing Dean Scott Goodnight. So it is the gentlemen who have met the dean that we must turn for our appraisal. And they have no little to say. They may not know, for instance, that he's the national president of Phi Eta Sigma, but they do know he's a hunter and a fisherman. They may not even know he's considered one of the best in the field, but they find out in a minute that he's remarkably easy to talk to and even easier to know. So for those who know a real guy when they see one, the Dean of Men holds as an office no terror. Instead, there's something almost unexplainable about sitting across the desk from this man and his pipe and being understood. I still think that's true. Scott Goodnight was a warm, extremely warm is the best word that comes to mind. He was a warm man and by no means unapproachable. At the Sigma Nu house, when we would have an important dinner, like an initiation ceremony dinner or some special occasion, we quite often invited him, and he quite often came. And he was a delightful guest, and by no means did he impose his presence on us. It was not like having the Dean of Men. It was like having a good friend. I had every respect in the world for Scott Goodnight. And I had lots of personal encounters with him, because naturally in The Troubleshooter and in The Cardinal and some other interviews, I quite often wrote what I hoped were provocative statements, and sometimes he would call me in and ask me simply to explain them. We didn't argue, we didn't debate, he certainly didn't bawl me out, he just wanted to know what I was talking about. Where did I learn such and such? How did I know such and such was true? And so forth. I never tried to deceive him, and he never tried to overrule me. I've already discussed President Glenn Frank. I thought he was a man of extremely erudite, worldly charm, and I bitterly regretted the fact that he was thrown out of the university, and I bitterly regretted the manner in which it was done, and still do. I think a great many of my fellow students shared my feeling that he was very badly treated as the distinguished president of a very distinguished university. What were my impressions of his replacement, Clarence Dykstra? I never got to know Dr. Dykstra very well. My impression now is he was a congenial man who smiled, and I have no other impression. I don't remember ever hearing anything that he said that I considered worth writing about in The Cardinal, or in my few personal encounters with him, I can't recall anything that he ever said to me that I find now memorable. He was a pleasant administrator, and that's as much as I knew about him. It asks here, why did I attend law school? And I think I've gone well into that earlier in this tape. Did I consider any other schools besides the University of Wisconsin for law school? No, of course I didn't, because I wanted to learn Wisconsin law. What type of hazing, if any, did first-year students undergo in law school? I find that question very odd. We took law school very seriously, and there was no time for hazing whatsoever. I remember a prominent teacher named Herbie Page taught contracts. Contracts is the essence of first-year law. And we lived in absolute terror of the fact that Herbie Page would call on you in law school and ask you to recite. So there was no time for hazing or fun or anything like that. Law school was serious business. I think I've already discussed my decision to leave law school and how Lloyd Garrison played a part in it. I left law school because I wanted to write. And I'm glad to say, as I said earlier, at his suggestion and his help, I went to New York, got a job. And a few months later, I transferred to the National Broadcasting Company. And to be modest about it, at age 23, I sold my first show to NBC. It was supposed to be a summer replacement for Bob Hope. I called it Mr. District Attorney. And we stayed on the air for 14 years, 52 weeks a year. I wrote all of them, 790-some scripts, and we were never out of the, what we call the sacred top 10 in ratings. So I was lucky. I started very young, and to conclude this, I have been even luckier as the years went on, because, as I said, I sold my first show when I was 23. And I have never been out of work since. I've always gone from one show to another. Even right up to the present day, I helped create Peyton Place. I helped create Dallas General Hospital, Medical Center. And one thing I've always been very, very grateful for is that I like what I do for a living. I would rather type a script than I can think of almost anything else. I have great sympathy for people who, while they inherited their father's businesses and are perhaps doing very well, perhaps have even become very rich, nevertheless really don't like what they do for a living. I love what I do. And I'm also now having the extreme pleasure of teaching other students at the University of California about television writing. And that, to me, is a very exciting way to wind up a career that's been a lot of fun. As a finale to this, I would like to add that I look back at the University of Wisconsin with great affection. I had a chance, as I said earlier, when I took a semester off and visited other campuses on behalf of Sigma Nu, to see other campuses. And none, in my opinion, compared to Madison. To go to school in a place with five lakes and a wonderful hodgepodge of students from all over, of all kinds, of all varieties, and to go to, especially to a big school, I'm very grateful for all of those things. The University of Wisconsin was very meaningful to me when I was there, and now, many, many years later, it is equally meaningful. I am very proud that I went there and very glad that I went there, and as long as I am able, I'll do anything I can to help the university. And I thank you also for letting me make this tape.